just read a couple of sections from my book, and I think all you need to know is that that this is a book about my late pit bull, Rosie, and I got her. I found her in the streets of New York in 1990 when she was a puppy, and I had her for 16 and three quarters years. And when I was a college professor in San Diego for 5 years. I've lived in New York. I grew up in Boston, and I left Boston in 1974. And I've lived in New York ever since. But for 5 years, I was a professor at the University of California and in San Diego. And San Diego is very warm and beautiful, and it's got lots of relationships to Boston. It's very interesting, including Ted Williams, if any of you know who he is. You know? I arrived at the airport, and there's a big photograph of Ted. I was like, Ted Williams? And he's from San Diego. I was like, okay, this is weird. But
he's known for this tunnel, right?
Yes. Yeah, is that way? I guess that's no, all. Yeah. He was known for the baseball card when I was a kid. But I guess he was the home run king at that moment. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful, warm place, which is both good for skateboarders and retirees. And because Rosie was an old dog, she was very happy there. And so she started to die, and I started to write about her. And that's pretty much how this book began. But it turned into many other things. So I'm going to read from the absolute beginning of the book. And then I'm going to skip to one of my favorite sections. One day in 1999, an awkward hand-addressed letter appeared in my hallway. The mailman threw everything on the stairs. I grabbed the letter and headed with Rosie to the dog run, which in that neighborhood was a skimpy triangle at 39th Street, west of 9th Avenue. It was an amazing perspective on midtown roofs and also dull traffic heading to New Jersey. My neighbors were weird, sad former actors. I liked the pink-cheeked older woman named Doris who walked every one of the neighborhood's dogs, including mine. This is like 16 years ago, so Doris is probably dead. Sitting on a bench while Rosie sniffed the ground, I tore open the strange note. It read, "Dear Eileen, I take the liberty of calling you Eileen to begin the unpleasant duty of forcing you to legally take responsibility for the damages you have inflicted over a period of 9 years upon the being you have taken to calling Rosie. I am Rosie's lawyer. Dog lawyers have only become possible in recent years, even months, which is not to say crimes of all kinds against dogs are new in any way. Crimes against dogs are ancient and widespread, but dogs having the wherewithal to attain legal representation is new indeed. My services have been retained thanks to a generous bequest by an anonymous donor who set up a foundation in her will for the explicit purpose of identifying dogs who were likely litigants, candidates for beginning the long and arduous process of getting the ball rolling on dogs' rights. It's been clear to my client during her life and most pressingly, at the time of her death, that the best way to make this need known would be to take up an individual dog's case, not the case of all dogs, which is too ubiquitous to pursue, in the explicit way the law makes possible for human litigants who are generally assumed to be individuals. A wealthy individual, of course, does not have more rights than a poor one. We are all brought up to honor human rights, but only wealthy humans are able to use the full force of the law, i.e., obtain high-quality representation. By this logic, there can be no freedom for dogs unless there are wealthy dogs. There is one today, the dog formerly known as Rosie. She has been left a significant sum of money in my client's will. She may spend it as she pleases, with the single stipulation that she obtain counsel and press charges against her owner for a variety of abuses and crimes against dog kind. As you know, Eileen Miles, that owner is you." It seemed unbelievable to me. Rosie was about 10. I looked at her licking an empty wrapper against the fence. She appeared entirely innocent of the letter's content. "What, are we already going home?" she seemed to say. Okay, I don't think she knows anything about this. I popped the leash back on and walked home planning my day. The loft we lived in was right across from Port Authority. Day and night, I watched the lights of buses sail in and out of the building. I thought about the letter from time to time, I mean for years. I showed it to people. They laughed and smiled. Could Rosie and my entire relationship be framed as blame? Did I force her to have sex with Buster that one time? No, twice. Could I write a book about that? I've never been an idea writer. I have like a spurt and then I go do something else. But this would be her book. A dog book is a great idea. Oh, thank you. So that's where it starts, and I won't even tell you at this moment the order of actually writing things, which is always different from the order of the book. But one thing I felt about this dog when I first got her was, and this is all true, of course, that's why I call it memoir, I'm telling the truth this time. When I first got her, I looked into her eyes, and I totally was like, it's my father. And my father was this very sweet guy named Ted Miles, who died in 1961 when he was 44 and I was 11, and there was alcoholism involved. But we were very close, and I totally felt like he would, the kind of guy he was, he would totally come back as my dog. He would totally do that just to hang out a little more. And so I went to this artist, Colony McDowell, and I was writing the book, and I decided, go for it, and just... I wrote a chapter called My Father Came Again as a Dog, and I explained how a man comes back as a dog, and it went on to alcoholism and what dogs are and what fish are, and made this essential joke, which is a big piece of the book, which is God, dog, you know, and I reversed them throughout, even make a 12-step program where people, the higher power is known as dog, which is a whole other vibe on alcoholism. But so I wrote this and I read it at McDowell, and people were like, that's great, but is Rosie going to talk? And I was like, you know, like, that's such a McDowell question. Is Rosie going to talk? But often things in my writing have been spurred by jokes or provocations like that. Like, I was like, okay, under what conditions would Rosie talk? And I, you know, I grew up in Arlington, and I went to Catholic school, and there was like a youth center. We didn't, you know, it was the day of the boys' club, not the girls' club. But the Catholic, our parish had like a Catholic youth center, and they had all these after-school art programs, which I took all of, in part because, I mean, I was both creative and I was growing up in an alcoholic household, so it was much better after school to just go take a class. And so I took clay making, I took ceramics, and I took a puppet class. So I have these great puppets I made when I was 9 with paper mache heads, and I've been thinking for years, well, I should make a video with the puppets, you know? So what I realized is if the puppets had a talk show and invited Rosie on, then she would talk. I mean, what would she do? Just sit there? You know, be like me stonewalling David, you know? So I'm going to read the beginning of the puppets talk show.
Can we get some water?
Can we get a water? Yeah.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you so much. The Puppets Talk Show. Oscar the host is a puppet. He has shiny black painted hair and bright red dots on both his cheeks. He's wearing a pair of blue overalls with very baggy suspenders and a blue and yellow striped shirt. One of his feet is gone and his pant leg is empty. Oscar, hello, hello, hello. Our guest tonight, Rosie, a dog, is here to set the record straight. All puppets, yay! Oscar, yes, Rosie is our guest. Thanks for coming, Rose. Rosie nods. Glad to be here, Oscar. Very glad, in fact. Rosie leans forward a bit in her chair, adjusting her butt. Oscar, puppets and dogs. A lot of folks probably can't see the connection between our kinds. I say balderdash. All puppets drumming. There's like a puppet drum circle, a very long row of puppets. Oscar, our studio audience, the kids. Oh, my God. You're like a full-service interlocutor. Incredible. Well,
moderator has to do something. So, good.
Thank you so much. Sure. Oscar, our studio audience, the kids. Camera pans to the kids. Just to the left of Oscar and Rosie is a short row of puppets. Bedelia, who has black yarn hair. Montgomery, a young guy with painted reddish hair. Casper, a ghost, a little more than a white clown head in a sheet, and finally, Crocky the crocodile, a pair of papier-mâché jaws going clack, clack, and a lower body of red and green upholstery material. Behind them are hundreds and thousands of puppets going back endlessly into the horizon, which becomes mountains and hills covered, I was thinking Italian painting, mountains and hills covered with puppets, all the puppets in the world. Rosie turns and returns to Oscar, smiling. Wow. Oscar, yeah, there's a lot of us. The meeting of puppets and dogs has been a long time coming, and you can see how important it is to our kind, puppet nation. No, puppet universe. Rosie, I hope I can do my kind justice. I mean, there's only one of me and there's a lot of dogs. Oscar, what do dogs want, Rosie? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you agreed to come in today and you can see what your being here means to us. And I hope you don't mind me being honest. You guys are generally considered the enemy, for good reason. Dogs historically have torn a good many puppets apart, torn to shreds. Camera close up on Oscar's face and a tiny tear is dripping down. Rosie, I get it, Oscar. A lot of wrong has been done. But those Oscar bows his head and then lifts a white hand. Oscar, those were ordinary dogs, Rosie? Is that what you were going to say? Oscar looks over at his wife, Bedelia, and all the puppets up in the hills. He regains his composure. Rosie, I think I would feel more comfortable on the floor. Hops down and plants her head on her paws, looking innocent. Oscar, forget it. You came here to talk with us, and it's time to move on. Dogs are pawns, and puppets are pawns. Let's face it, puppets are puppets. People put their hands in us. They enter our heads and our bodies and make us say things, whether we believe them or not. Rosie, over her shoulder, people put us on leashes. People feed us on the floor. They put us to sleep. People put us down. Oscar, right, and that doesn't happen to us. But now that you're animated, we've got a lot more in common. All it takes to see things fresh is the right opportunity, a good invite. Oscar looks around proudly to be on our show. Rosie hops back on chair. And how many dogs get this, Oscar? How many dogs are called? I'm grateful I was called. I always was. I guess that's why I'm here. Oscar, what was it like? Rosie, what was what like? Oscar, I don't know how to put it. The fame? I mean, you're definitely getting famous right now. You've been written about, like Lady Di. You're basically being deified. Flips through the pages of a galley, nodding, as well as defiled. Rosie, no great shakes, Oscar. Big dog, little dog, all the same. Humans are the problem, I think you'll agree. Oscar, nodding, All puppets. A murmuring begins with Oscar's low hum and cascades all the way back up the mountain like a growly bell or a quake. Oscar, you just touched the rock, my friend. Rosie, the one I had rode me like a car. She was interested in how she abused me. She wrote about it. She wrote about it extensively. That's why I'm here, right? When I died, she described the way my body was treated. Paw pushed in plaster like a criminal or a child. They made a rosy souvenir before they threw me in the fire. Then, and only then, and oh yeah, when I was dying, get this, when they're wheeling me around town like a man who has money. And then she writes on her long legal pad, puppetry. She gets the idea that I was used, treated like I was empty. Great. Yeah, well, how about my whole long life, Eileen? Rosie, that was your name for her? No, sorry, Oscar, that was your name for her? Rosie, no, it was not. I called her Jethro. That was my name for her, and believe me, I got in more than one fight defending that name. I tell a few other dogs in the park, ugh, here comes Jethro. When she's loping towards me with her big smile and a rope, like it's good news, I gotta go home for hours and sit on the floor. Yet I had a certain amount of loyalty. The dogs in the park got snickering and telling all the other dogs, look, Jethro. I wasn't down for that shit, laughing at her. That's part of why dogs in captivity, but that's pretty much all dogs, we're known for our loyalty. We stay with the hand we were dealt, and we generally will fight for it. Dogs do have choices. Unlike you guys, we can move on our own, and some dogs totally do. Go to Mexico, for instance, and live your own life. Then you can also fucking starve on those streets. But yeah, there's a lot of us down there. I guess anything's better than getting gassed as a pup. But my point was that I was very often defending her and getting myself in fights in the dog run for years. And did she have any idea? First she tries to get me knocked up, has me raped. And that is in the book to her credit. Later she decides, no, that's not what I want. And she has my insides yanked out. Puppets all aghast, all puppets. Rosie, you didn't know about that? Spaying? Oscar, they take your copy thing away. That's it, isn't it, Rosie? Still, do you want more dogs? Isn't that the argument, alleviating dog suffering? Rosie, yes, we want more dogs. Do you want more puppets? Rosie turns and looks up the mountain and beyond. We want to outnumber humans and turn it around. Not in a warlike fashion, but gentle, you know. We're doing it from the inside out already. That's what this book means. We are talking to our masters, very gently and subtly. Dogs are true leaders and strong teachers, as the life of Eileen Miles after my own life will show. Life is short. That's the problem. It's very hard for one dog to do much in one lifetime. 16 years? By the time you hit your message, your body's failing. Oscar, so there's some truth. Rosie, truth to what? Eyebrows raise. Oscar, well, here's your book, Afterglow. It's right on my knee, and what I'm hearing now from you is that it's not so clear how much of the work here is yours. Oscar turns towards the camera, waving the book. Authorship. Who's writing who?
Thanks so much, Eileen. It strikes me there are many different ways to read the book. You can read it as a dog lover or dog owner. I had two dogs, and we over the last few years lost one and then lost the other. So I approached this work as a from the memoir point of view. Mm-hmm. But that's only one way of reading the book. You could easily read this, and perhaps one should, as a social commentary, a social critique, class systems, divisions between members of society. So could you talk a little bit about how you put this together? At one level, it's about your dog and the loss, but it's equally a social commentary.
Right. Well, I think part of it always is that as you're writing, the world is always changing. Mm. And then new things, it's almost like driving a car writing. It's sort of like you're moving, and yet it's all moving, and then things start to the landscape of what you're saying is suddenly flashing by, and you're like, oh yeah, And so even now that the book is written, the world around is changed. I mean, there's a chapter in here called The Rape of Rosie, and it's horrifying, and it always was horrifying because I decided my dog should have puppies, whether she wanted to or not. And we did this horrendous thing in my apartment one night, which is we brought in a male dog and we made her have sex. Yeah. And it was bad, and I wrote it like in 1992 when I was running for president of the United States, which I don't know, I was a write-in candidate, and it was definitely part of the politics of the 90s to say that women aren't represented, queers aren't represented, people who make under $50,000 a year aren't represented. So I was doing that, and I had to come up with a platform. And I thought, what else could it be besides total disclosure? Because I thought, candidates don't write their own speeches. They don't tell you what they're thinking. They're not honest. And I thought the very least I can offer is total honesty. Mm-hmm. So that meant having to acknowledge things before they became scandals. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that I had my dog raped seemed like something the voter should know about before they voted for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we heard you read a couple of things that were somewhat whimsical and playful,
right,
but that's a particularly graphic chapter in the novel as well, in the memoir as well.
It's horrendous, and suddenly when we're in this moment right now of sexual harassment and assault, and it's just like, it's particularly true, both about, as you said, like, who has more status in society, who's in charge, who has power, who has the right to touch whose bodies, but also who has the right to touch an animal's body, I mean, accidentally I've stopped eating meat during this book tour, and I don't know whether it has to do with thinking this much about an animal. So I think that was happening while I was writing too, and just more stuff. Plus, there's always a jokey thing too. I think part of driving your writing is making yourself laugh and giving yourself energy so you'll keep working, because I'm really inherently lazy by nature, and so I have to make tricks to get myself going.
Well, it also pulls the reader in, because it seems it's entertaining to start with, and then suddenly you're in this social critique that makes you really, really think about the structures of what society is right now. So
I think bait and switch is one of the primary tools in writing. You think this is a dog book? Oh no, like that. And then
I was totally screwed on that.
No.
But I think it is as well. And I think did you start out with that plan, or did it emerge as you were writing?
Oh, it totally emerged, because it really was just so, I'm there in San Diego and my beloved pit bull starts dying, and there was nothing else to do but write about her. That's what I know how to do. Mm-hmm. I start copying. In a way, I'm like, as a writer, I feel like I'm somebody who grew up drawing and that at a certain point I just changed cars and became a writer. But my one idea with writing is copying. You know, like I write what I see, whether it's inside or outside. So I was doing that, and so I guess I did it for about 50 pages. Like I, at a certain point, I thought, oh my God, because when she was dying, I was just, you know, mopping up her piss, and I just let her die for 6 months. I didn't put her down right away. I hung in there with it, and it was so intense, and I'd never been that close to somebody who was dying, like, for the whole thing, and especially because I had been with her since she was a puppy, so it became very spiritual, like I thought, and plus, I'm of the generation who's, so many of my friends died of AIDS, and so I saw parts of their dying, and I visited the dying, but I had never done the whole, the thing about a dog life is that it's 15 or 16 years long, so conceivably, you could have 5 dogs in your life. And so they're like these mini existences, and you get to do the, so there was suddenly a spiritual thing, and then that happened, and but then after that it became like, how can I keep the book going? And so then it became different moves.
Why do you think we hold animals as such precious components of our lives, those that are dog owners or cat owners or other animals? What is it about that four-legged creature, or that's not a human, but it's another living creature that becomes such a part of our life. What does that do for us? Because I'm not sure our ancestors would have thought of dogs or animals in exactly the way that we do in 20th or 21st century.
Right. I mean, we call them a companion species, right? And I think, like you say, I think that's a new development. Before, I don't know what they were. They were there to eat the garbage. They were there to go hunting with you. So I feel like as we've changed, they've changed. But just the fact that they're called a companion species means the deal is you're with me, right? You know, and part of it is that, you know, because I'm feeding you, because I'm taking you to the doctor, because I'm taking you for walks, because you're completely dependent on me. But we get this mammalian hit that we get from nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, which is to say my girlfriend, my partner, my family doesn't have to go for a walk on the beach with me, whether they like it or not, you know?
Yeah.
And also, they don't need it, you know? So there's just kind of a way in which it, for me, it replants me, it gets me out of my head, and gets me on earth, you know? And so I can dream all I want, but my feet are on the ground where the dog, I think the dog needs to go, and then the dog tells me where it needs to go.
Right.
And that's really interesting.
Right. There's one point in the book where I think you take that and make it more explicit about loyalty, presence in the moment, and you're there together. It's not a contracted relationship or a marriage or some other way of enshrining a relationship. You're just there together, and there's loyalty, there's friendship, there's all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when one gets to the stage of loss, it is like losing. Is it like losing another person?
Absolutely. I mean, I believe in animal personhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that great Gertrude Stein line about, I know I am I, because I always misquote it because my little dog knows me, you know, and it's just that the person who sees me, like, on so many intimate levels is the animal. But also, you know, it's so weird that you know, language is the problem, and there's also the connection, disconnection, because the thing is, it's sort of like she never could speak. She never could object. You know, I mean, even that my joke is that I've written an objection for her. You know, I've written a lawsuit for her about what a jerk I am. But the fact is, she just had to put up with this jerk, you know, and that was because she couldn't speak, you know. And so even here, I've imposed a whole narrative upon her. But what I remember most of all is what we did that was beyond language. I mean, I think the most profound moment with an animal always is when you're out in the country and you hear a loud bang, and then the two of you look into each other's eyes like, what was that? You know, and it's so like you're looking into wildness, but that thing you heard was wild. And I'm an animal, and I don't know what that is, and the dog does not know what that is either. And it's like the dog's death is like that too. You know, it's that absolute, you know.
Well, we share identity as animals. We may think of ourselves in different ways, but we are in that together in some way. So I think that comes through. How did the idea of the lawsuit come to you?
I have two answers. One is I have no idea, and the other is sheer guilt, right? Because to live in the city with a dog. People are always like, I'd love to get a dog, but you know, you can't have a dog in the city. And then, you know, I was driving to New York the other day, and there was so, I was like, what? There are so many dogs in New York, mm-hmm. and people really want dogs in the mm-hmm. city. And yet, it's like, so many times, like, I'd be in my apartment, and I would think, oh my God, it's like 7 o'clock, I gotta go to that opening. And then I'd look at Rosie, and I'd think, oh no, I didn't take her out. And so, she gets the shitty walk. Yeah. You know, like we get to the corner.
Sometimes literally, right?
Well, always, hopefully. Yeah. But we're taking the right, and she's like, oh, no, not that walk. She knows that's not her good walk. That's the lousy one, you know. And so there's a million times when I would be running her up the stairs, and I would turn around and see her pit bull head. And, I mean, and I always thought of that face as thinking, fuck you, Eileen, fuck you, Eileen, you know.
And like so the interaction with the puppets in some ways.
So the letter is that, if she were to speak, you know. And so I think, but what's weird is that out of the blue I wrote it in like 1999. Mm-hmm. Like I just, it just was a freestanding piece that I thought, how funny, how great it would be if I was that writer. I could write this funny dog, you know, lawsuit, you know, and then I showed it to people, I read it, I put it in a student magazine, and then it just did nothing for all these years. And then once I started writing this book, I was like, and once she was dead and I was done with her dying, I thought, oh, that letter, you know. And then the problem of the letter drove the book in many ways, mm-hmm. like where to put the letter. Like mm-hmm. the letter shows up in the Puppets Talk mm-hmm. show at a certain point, mm-hmm. you know, the puppets know about the letter.
Right. There is a part later in the book where it feels like you're in dialogue with Rosie as well. So could you just talk a little bit about that? I don't want to give away any secrets because I hope everybody reads the book, but there is a sense where you're also giving her the opportunity to look at the book and be in dialogue with you, I think.
Mm-hmm. I have a literary hero who lives in Boston. She's probably not in the room, but Fanny Howe. Do you know Fanny Howe?
I don't, but I know the name.
She's a poet and a fiction writer, and I think she grew up in Boston. Like her mother was an Irish woman who started Poets Theatre in Cambridge, and her father taught at Harvard and so on. And she's in and out of Boston. She's 10 years older than me, so she's like in her 70s, but she's a great writer. And we both have Irish citizenship through our families. And so Fanny's always like the friend who's 10 years ahead of me. And so Fanny taught in San Diego. Fanny left her job. They hired Eileen. Mm. You know, it's kind of like I follow Fanny. Mm. And so when I got a Guggenheim, I'd always planned to go to Ireland when I got a Guggenheim. And I applied for like 20 or 30 years. And I finally got a Guggenheim. So I went to Ireland, but I beforehand I asked Fanny where to go, and she gave me the Fanny list. And one of the places was Glenstall Abbey.
Oh, yeah.
And have you been there?
Yeah, I grew up in Dublin, so there's another
God.
Reason that this is an interesting
oh, wow.
conversation.
Yeah, very Irish
oh,
book.
Yeah, Glenstall is beautiful.
Yeah, it's incredible. And Fanny said, whatever your spiritual practice is, it's a great place to write. And so I went there, and so I was there, and I needed about 35 more pages of the book. Mm. And I was like, come on. And suddenly I really felt like Rosie came to me. Mm. And she was like, Eileen, let's finish the book. I have an idea. It's a tapestry. Uh-huh. So you weave, I'll dictate, you know. Uh-huh. And I love tapestries, and there's uh-huh. great ones in the UK at the V&A Museum. Sure. And so I just kind of, I both did research and looked at tapestries and thought about it and just let her say everything in the world of the book and everything she might need to still tell me. And it was very organic letting her speak.
Let's move to the social commentary part of this, if we could. In some ways, you could use Rosie or dog kind as a stand-in for any oppressed minority or any structurally constrained grouping in modern society. So that's a very powerful thread that runs through a lot of the book. How deliberate was that? I mean, I know you ran for office, you've been an activist, uh-huh. so that must be present in your consciousness, but how did that show up in the book the way that it came to life?
I mean, I think that you can't miss it, you know, right. if you look, you're looking at, quote, a master-slave relationship. Mm-hmm. You're looking at somebody who's supposed to accept that they're on a leash, you know, and that you are running the show. Mm-hmm. And there's something comforting and something abhorrent in that. And so it's like it becomes part of the, and I think when I was doing research for the book, I was reading sci-fi, I was reading travel books, I was reading slave narratives. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't conscious. I think the thing that's funny about a book is that you know what you can't read. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain kinds of books, certain kinds of writers, certain kinds of voices I knew I didn't want to hear because they were a little too close to mine and I felt like they were going to take my space. But there were other kind of things that I just felt like they would just broaden the space of the book, you know? And so I just gathered, and I can't say that those things literally went into there, but I felt like they made the adventure of the book and they made the texture of the tapestry, weirdly.
I mean, the stuff on sexual taboo is kind of interesting. You know, the rape of Rosie, that section. It's as I said earlier, it's graphic, but it's an important part of this, you know, master slave analysis that you're trying to do, or this ownership motif that you're trying to unpack. So was that difficult to write, or was that just that's what the story called for at the time? So down on paper it goes.
I don't know that you can write something like that if you don't feel like something like that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I'm female. I'm a queer. I grew up working class. I didn't have a great education, but I did in a way. And you know, I'm a rape victim. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I just feel like one could pile up so many ways in which they felt like the subaltern, and yet I'm a white person. Do I claim it? Am I able to claim it? You know, but certainly a dog can hold all those things and hold that heart of pain. You know, that body of suffering. You know, it's sort of like it's a dog's life.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what that means. It's because they hold feeling for us. Yeah. You know, and it's like, and they don't talk about it. They just hold it, you know, and they return it. And so I think it was a way to really speak to that plight. I mean, and again, it's always through jokes. Mm. You know, like when I ran for office, she was my running mate. You know, and because part of it was not necessarily, I wasn't in a relationship at the time, but it was unstable, and my girlfriend probably wouldn't want her to have been on campaign buttons, but we could just put Rosie on it, you know, and that's both great and again more dominance, you know.
Right. But she also might have chosen to be on it with you too. So I think what you've transitioned to is in telling us that some of this is autobiographical as well in terms of how you do this.
Oh, it's deeply. I mean, it's in. In fact, it's the most unabashedly autobiographical book I've ever written, I think. And I think the thing for me, it's so interesting stylistically, is which means fiction. You know, which means truth in fiction, because I think the act of writing is fictional. You know, you're always, and also every relationship, it's sort of like if you have a cat, you know, you and your partner at some point start making fake language for the cat and talking. I mean, like we all have these family languages and these dog languages and the cat languages, and I think fantasy is such a part of reality. You know, it's not like art's over here and fantasy's over here and now we're doing memoir. It's sort of like they really grow right out of each other. And so it was such an exercise in that to think if I tried to tell the truth, I would start spinning things because that's what I do in my house.
Right. And, you know, we live in an era today where I think we're all trying to struggle with how to tell fiction from nonfiction, truth in fiction, truth in nonfiction. I won't use that awful expression that we hear in the media right now, but, fake news. So so we're trying to rebut these deconstructive moments of how things are falling apart. So, you know, the act of writing here, it seems like, provides an opportunity to tell truths. You can tell it through telling stories, but it's no less true and no less significant. Is that a conscious process that you engage on to try and bring truths out, or... So this is really a question about your creative writing style.
Right. I mean, I feel like truth is a road, you know? And I think you know you're on it, you know what I mean? I think, like, one of the most interesting things I'm thinking about intuition, and there's a word I found once. I was reading a Roland Barthes book. I think it was Roland Barthes by Roland Barthes. And I don't read a ton of theory, but when I do read theory, I'm like very diligent and I look up every word. And there was this word, co-anesthetic. And it meant, it was so interesting. It meant, it's a study of intuition, really. And it's like supposedly music theory people and early childhood people are very interested in this. Because what it means is, we all know that thing about like orphans and orphanages, you know, it's like they don't get held enough, and so they develop weird. But apparently being talked to and sung to from different spatial distances in the room is how you develop your intuition, they believe. It's a sonic thing. So it's sort of like, you know, the difference between, like, if you're the infant and I'm like, hello, 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 la, 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 all of that is how you start to create a map of the world as the baby.
Right. Right.
And
right.
if the baby is not talked to, period, but also not talked to in a wide way, a wide variety of ways, the baby doesn't develop. The baby is flat, and the baby doesn't develop intuition, you know? And so I feel like that was so exciting to me, and I've often thought in the act of writing, you imagine something over there, you imagine something here. It's sort of like, I can build that world. Mr. Soundman, I just dropped my...
There
oh,
go.
I think it's okay.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Are we cool? We have a sonic convention.
We have a couple of minutes just for our section, so if you're thinking of questions to ask, please be preparing them in your mind, and then we'll ask people to come up to the microphone, because some of these clips may be for WBUR, so we want to have a record of the questions that you have. So just in a minute or two, we'll invite you for your questions. It's the new book award honor that we have.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's the heady. It's a good. You guys hear me?
Yeah, great.
Yay, thank you.
So you ran for office also.
Can I finish?
Oh, sorry, go right ahead.
So I just wanted to say that sonic map is I feel like, is like the net that I'm working in. And they also say that shrinks aren't good because they hear you and are thinking about what you said. They're listening to how you say it. And that's, you know, so anyway, that's the sound system I'm in.
So that was in response to my question about how intuitive this is, how you brought truth alive, and it's a road, and it's part of that sort of intuitive thing that you found in Barth.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's other interesting tie-ins with, because it gets a little crazy in spots where it feels in that existentialist absurd moment. So that's Barth, that's Camus that you're channeling in some ways from that period.
And
so
theosophy.
Sure.
I don't know if you read any of that Madame Blavatsky and what's her name? It's just like the people at the beginning of the 20th century, like that Yeats was interested in. And it's like when I was younger, every time I would stop drinking, I would go to this occult bookstore in New York and read all this crazy theosophy. And I think the thing that's interesting about reading is where does it go, you know? And I think it winds up in a book years later. So there's a lot of nut stuff in this book that I'm sort of proud of.
Awesome. You did run in 92.
Yes, yes.
Would you have run in 2016?
You know, I was tempted. I was feeling it a little bit, you know? But then finally, I just, you know, like I learned in 92 what a huge job it is to run for president. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, like even a small campaign is 24/7. Mm-hmm. Once if you say I'm running for president, and to say there's a year or a year and a half between that moment and the election, every moment of your life is somebody saying, so what are you thinking today? What do you think about this? People giving you information, people inviting you to dinner, and at dinner you're like just sitting there and they're like, so tell us about your campaign. Mm-hmm. It does not stop. I mean, I have a real sense of awe for what it means to be a candidate, and you know, I'll
good. So,
but not a president. Not what it means to be a president. Yeah.
So, why don't we pause there? Please join me in thanking Eileen for her comments, and we'll invite members of the audience to bring up their questions. And we have about 15 or 20 minutes for questions. So, if you have one, please approach the microphone.
I wonder, I have two getting elderly pits, and they're the most amazing dogs of all my lifetime. There's always been a dog in my life. And they're male and female, and they're both neutered and spayed. And I would so much have loved to have them have puppies. And I wonder, did Rosie have puppies?
No, she didn't have puppies. I mean, we tried a couple of times, and then I think the last time I went to the vet, we were going to see if he was feeling her belly for a little, you know. And he was like, he looked up at me and he goes, you know, some dogs just don't want to have puppies. And I said, it was a real hit of authenticity. I was like, I know, me too, you know. And I, at that point, we decided to move the other, you know.
Was your wanting her to have puppies, was that? I would like my dogs to have puppies. I don't have children, and I would have loved to have puppies running around the house.
I think it was totally that. I wanted to be. I mean, the same way that when I say the dog is like a map of life, this short little life. Part of what she had the capacity to do was have puppies, and I wanted to watch, I wanted to see it, I wanted to be there. I mean, I found her when she was part of a litter. I found her when she was nursing. So narratively emotionally.
Like really literally.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
So that's what I wanted, but you can't always get what you want, right?
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Those five people who walked out of the room were just loaded with questions. They were like...
I heard a dog medium speak a couple months ago, and something she was like very insistent on was that your animals want to come back sometimes in other animals to like let you know that they're doing okay, almost as like a validation to their owner or something.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if, like, as you've been reading from this book, if you've had any experiences with like Rosie communicating with you or anything like
that. It's totally in the book.
Yeah.
When she was dying, there's somebody named Don Allen who's in Western Mass, and it was very weird because I think I was in Los Angeles, and I was having dinner with some friends, and one was from Western Mass, one was from Los Angeles. We started talking about, and Rosie was dying then, and we were talking about animal communicators because I was like, what is she hanging on for? And they both knew of an animal communicator, and it turned out to be the same one. And I was like, okay, I got to go to this person. And she was amazing. I mean, she just, who knows? I mean, I like tarot, astrology, psychic. I'm for all of it, which is not to say that I think I put my faith in any of it, but I feel it. You know, I think it's another intuitive situation. And she was so good telling me what Rosie was feeling at the end of her life, why she liked San Diego, how I should proceed. It was incredible. Though weirdly, I've gone to her with my current dog, and it wasn't as good. Mm. But the puppets called her our pup. Puppets referred to her, Don Allen, as our puppet.
Lovely.
Hi, Eileen.
Hello.
May I ask two questions?
Please.
The first is, you had mentioned that when you were doing research for this book, there are some things that you read voraciously and others that you intentionally avoided because they're somehow getting in the way. And can you give an example of that and why?
It's more like particular authors that I'm sort of either friends with or fans of, and I feel like we're sort of in a similar writing school and we kind of vibe, and I just don't want to know what territory they're covering right now because I feel like we are related. It's sort of like staying away from your family at certain points or something. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like they might be doubling me, or they just interfered with my sense of space. I don't even know how to. It feels like it just. Whenever I feel taboos when I'm in the writing process, I'm very superstitious. And there were just certain. It was more like certain writers rather than. And I didn't read dog books. Though every now and then a weird one, like there's a writer, what's his name, Bulgakov, Mikhail Bulgakov. He wrote Master and Marguerite, mm-hmm. and he has one called Heart of a Dog, and it's amazing. It's really amazing. And there are a few that I read Fanny Howe's dog book. I forget what it's called. It was good, but mostly I avoided. I read Marley and Me because I thought that's the cliche, but I didn't read Mary Oliver's or Mark Doty's. I mean, there were so many dog books, and I avoided the genre largely.
The second question was, you mentioned this was your most autobiographical book, and I haven't read it, I'm sorry to say, but more so than Cool for You?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mostly because I think the feelings, there was some way in which, because I was talking about Rosie, I could incidentally talk about the relationships I was in at the time and say things that felt kind of secret about what it's like to be in a relationship with another human. Like it just, that certain tanks were open, that at least for me. And the thing that's so funny about intimacy and what's embarrassing is what I find embarrassing or intimate or revelatory may not be what somebody reads. You know, like people are like, you're so open and honest with your work. But I know what I'm keeping out. You know, I know what the boundaries are. So I always feel like it's fiction, not memoir, because I'm really shaping it so much. And I also think order is really important. When you change the order of things, you really change the meaning of it. which I did do here too, but I just felt like there was something about the vibration of intimacy was just higher in my own mind. Even talking about God, I mean, like if somebody went to Catholic schools, talking about God and my feeling about God felt like this is really out of the, you know, like this is really exposing myself. That's my private life, you know.
Thank you very much. And I do want to say, Cool for You is a great book, and if anybody here hasn't read it, I think they'd enjoy it.
Thank you so much. I think it's my most Boston book. It's growing up. Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much. This is fantastic. I am going to pose a question that I hope is challenging and not challenging in a good way.
This challenge.
So I love the master-slave metaphor and the ability to use the relationship as a symbol for metaphor for so many things. But I'm sitting here and my brain is going back and forth between being so stimulated intellectually by the parallels you're drawing and the things you're saying and the cultural critique, and then I'm looking at the photograph of the cover and I'm picturing myself reading this in translation as a citizen or not citizen of certain parts of the world, and I'm thinking, how much of this is ironic? How much is the author acknowledging that this is written from a place of extreme privilege? And it's puzzling me.
Tell me what that means. How so? Are the parts of the world privileged? Tell me.
To have the ability to write a book about a relationship with an animal, I think by a lot of people would be considered in some way frivolous. And I wondered if you had any consciousness.
Are you eliding frivolous and privilege?
In some ways. Not that I think you can't operate from a place of privilege and use whatever you want.
I want to ask you more questions than I want. Are we obliged to, is certain content more valuable than others? Are we sort of obliged to write about certain things or in a certain way?
From a humanistic standpoint, certain choice of metaphor is more respectful than others. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Could you repeat that again, the choice of metaphor?
So I think from a, you know, looking globally at the extreme hierarchy of human experience,
right,
we're in a place here in America as the members of the intellectual elite and how it roofs over our head and whatnot, that, you know, to be able to be an intellectual and a writer who can choose as a topic a relationship with an animal as the lens through which to look at these cultural issues. So I just wondered if, because there is so much humor in it as well, if you were aware of that while you were writing. I'm not saying it's a good or a bad thing, but I think it's important to.
I'm still finding you're that hard to locate. The choice of an animal as a narrator is privileged.
So Marley and Me is...
This is not Marley and Me, but go ahead, let's hear it.
No, I understand, but Marley and Me is the cliche version of a dog book.
Sure.
This is a very different version of a dog book,
sure,
but it's a dog book.
Right.
And so I'm wondering how aware you were of that potential problem in writing it.
No, I don't buy this problem for a second.
Okay.
I feel like dogs are global. Dogs are weird. There's a great movie about cats and Turkey that show you so much about Istanbul and globalization and gentrification and, you know, I mean, like, I think that, pardon me?
I didn't say anything.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I just think that animals are kind of our wand sometimes for seeing more rather than seeing less. And I think in fact it's in a way there might be some unprivileging in terms of being more honest about, I don't know how to go down that road. I guess I don't feel it at all. I'm not sure I can understand the value system that you're, I think, enacting that I'm just not buying.
I think I'm imagining myself as a woman living in a very different socioeconomic demographic
and
that
I'm
in. And
she doesn't have a
living
dog?
In a
she
different
doesn't like a dog book?
Well, maybe she has a dog who's running around in the streets, but if she had the ability to choose a book to read by an American intellectual, how would she perceive the writing of a dog book as the choice?
She would love it.
Great.
We have a couple more questions coming, so let's go to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this conversation, and congratulations on the book. I haven't had a chance to read this yet, but I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the puppets, because puppets kind of give me the creeps. And I'm just thinking, you know, being and both sides, being a puppet master, feeling like I'm a puppet, you know, seeing puppet shows, what's really going on. And I think the whole history, you know, that Japan puppets, and it's an ancient art. So I'm just curious, you know, with 9-year-old puppets, that's so amazing. And that those are, like, just how that side of the story, if you wanted to say a little bit more about that, however you want to take it.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes, truly, it's sort of like, I think, the iconography of any book has to do with the studio of the artist that wrote it, in a way. And that might mean your apartment, your neighborhood, your history, your, you know. So truly, the puppets were just there, you know, and subject matter, you know, in the same way that any still life, there's like the skull, and there's like a naked woman, and there's a bouquet of flowers, and you're like, we just think of that as the shit of art at a certain point in time. Or Morandi just painted a vase for 30 years, or there's a guy in the UK that painted a glass of water every day for 40 years, you know? So truly, in the most simple way, the puppets are in the book because I have the puppets, and they're my most privileged, proudest possession, you know? And sort of like, and they've been like a lot of the time when you're writing a book, it's sort of like there's an ache you've been having for a long time, like, when do I get to use the puppets? You know, and so it was very, you know, like suddenly, you know, when I made a joke with myself, I saw that they could kick in and be in here, because I was in a period of time where I was really waiting to use them as subject matter. And
I think that they became a third party perspective, because they weren't human and they weren't dog as well. So it's like this third space that they create.
Exactly, and it becomes it's a camera angle in a way. You know, I think it's sort of like the inanimate and the animate. It's sort of like, and it also it raised Rosie to reality, which is so crazy. You know, it's sort of like the puppet's unreality made the reality of the dog speaking. It animated it, you know, and so the puppets literally were a device. But it's like, because I made puppets when I was a child, I love puppets, and I go to puppet things, and I'm very much a puppet person. And I think puppets are hot, right? I mean, maybe not as hot as they were 5 years ago, but it's in the art world, though, it's just like, there were puppet festivals, and you can get an MFA in puppetry at Cal Arts, you know, and I was like, that blew me away. And now that's like an old program. I was like, that puppetry program. You know, I still have one little ache from the question before, though. I just, because I didn't want to dismiss when I said I love my book or I love, you know, I just feel like there was just it was a suggestion of a moralized seeing in writing, which I don't think, or that there are people who will read this system in a certain way, and I think we can't. I just feel like we can't unprivilege people and decide how they see and how we will be judged from the. We can't.
Yeah, I heard a
make a hierarchy of content and say that this is the right book to write and this is the book that they will be offended by, you know. That's still not a total expression of what it is that I, this, and I don't mean discomfort like how dare you, but just, you know, like that question is a good one and a troubling one. But thank you for asking it.
Yeah, I heard a piece of that that was, would this be accessible globally? I mean, I think you've answered that part of it. And I also heard from my own lens a piece about, well, we have a sense of privilege by being able to have these kind of conversations and these kind of processes. But my personal take on that is that, well, we have an obligation, because we have more than some others do, to tell our stories and to share them and bring people along. I don't know if that maps to your experience as well, Eileen.
Yeah. Also, I was in Palestine in May, and we were doing readings, and I felt like all of us who were, you know, I mean, we were pretty much, we were white, and we were of color, and we were UK and American and of Middle Eastern extraction, a lot of us, and I think that we were all feeling a little obliged to be political. And I read, you know, Rosie Talking in Palestine, because I just thought, I just want to attribute literary pleasure, the desire for pleasure, to you guys, and not think I'm an American second-guessing what political comfort would be. And people were very grateful for it. They were like, thank God, because people are always coming here attributing us only being on the edge and wanting you to pledge that we're there for you and all this stuff. And they loved hearing a talking dog and craziness. You know?
Thank you for your patience. We'll take these last two questions, and that will close the session.
Thank okay. Thank you. So what I found interesting when I listened to the previous question about privilege is it made me think about this summer riding around with the dog in the back seat and the windows down and riding by the same girl panhandling every single day. Mm-hmm. And I can afford to feed a dog. Mm-hmm. So that's what made me think. That's where my mind went when she mentioned the word privilege, mm-hmm. is that I questioned my ability not just to feed another human. I've had a family, raised right. kids, all of that. But the ability to incorporate in my budget for my family and myself the ability to feed another animal.
Right, right.
So that's what I thought. And then, but my question was about intuition and how an example maybe of how you connected. Like, do you think Rosie read your mind? Did you connect on an intuitive level with the animals so that, like those times you say you look in each other's eyes, mm-hmm. you kind of are thinking the same thing?
Yeah.
Do you have an example or anything you would share about that kind of moment? But you do agree that, like, intuitively they know you better maybe than any other animal.
Yeah.
Or person.
No, I mean, I certainly absolutely experienced a feeling that she was reading my mind and I was reading. But I think, because part of that is minds are a lot more transparent than we like to think. You know, it's like I talk a lot about Neanderthals, but because I have this made up thing that Neanderthals communicated through, you know, kind of a telepathy. You know, but I think that, like, when we watch animals and we watch birds go off in formation, we certainly know that they're communicating through a radar of sorts. And I think when you start to be silent with an animal and stop using language, you start to work in this other way. And some of it is training and, you know, and obedience. But other parts, it's sort of like, you know, when you start to know, I know when she's going to shit, you know. I know when she's, there were certain physical things I became completely in tune to. The way you do with partners and family members, the way women's menses line up when you start to live around each other. And it's sort of like, is that ESP or is that just this animal call where we're just suddenly living in a rhythm? You know, I think rhythm almost is truer than intuition in a way, that you start to be in a space that's architectural and real. Thank you. Hi.
Last question.
Hi. So I've only had one dog in my life and we got him when I was really little. And I know when you've had a dog in your life for so long, sometimes you dream about them. And for me, when my dog died eventually, I think I was like 18 or 19, and I would have all of these dreams about him, and he would be talking. And I noticed that he had a voice similar to my dad's, and which is a little weird. But I think... like you said, you know, there's a dog's life is so short and it's like a snapshot kind of this one point in our lives. And so how much of that is projected? And so, you know, like going off of the last question, when you look in your dog's eyes and you have this connection and you hear their voice in some to some capacity, how mm-hmm. much of that is, you know, a projection of all the voices around you. For me, it was probably my dad because my dog was like so good and my dad was like the voice of all the things that are supposed to be good versus bad. And so have you ever had any dreams with Rosie in them? And what is Rosie's voice like to you?
That's so great. I feel like I have, and it's like I can't even literally answer that for sure. I feel like I know I've woken up some mornings and been bright and happy because this really unbelievable occurrence happened in the dream, and I feel like once or twice over the years Rosie's been in there and it was just like what was going on. In the same way that once or twice after my dad died he was in my dreams, and actually it usually wasn't a good one, it was scary, you know, but there he was. What was the second part of the question? Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's so interesting, I feel like we spend our lot, I mean, this is not such a good answer, but I want to give it, which is like, what are dreams? What the fuck are dreams, right? And all I could think of is that they made art. They created art. Just because we dream, some of us decide that what we're going to do with our lives is make art, you know? And sometimes it's almost like, I think language is this sense of captioning our dreams. You know, I mean, I love social media because suddenly, you know, we have the capacity to put pictures out there and then we caption them, or we just put fragments of language out there, and they're starting to be like kind of a global mind. But I think that all the time we're kind of like writing this running header, or what do you call it, subtitles all the time for what you're seeing, and you're talking and you're talking and talking. And so I think it's sort of like, it is kind of a second dog body in a way. It's sort of like, I think I only know what she sounds like because I knew what she looked like, and that memory is still inside of me. And so I can still write that running text for the transcript of what she's feeling and seeing and what it could be. But, you know, it's a dream.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you all for your questions. I'm sure we could continue going for quite some time, but we're at the end of our hour.
Thank you, David.
And,
you're so great.
Thank you. And Eileen will be available for book signing at the rear of the room in just a minute. But please join me one final time in thanking Eileen for this wonderful book, Afterglow.